The Pennsylvania Supreme Court renders its final decision on the state's natural gas law. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports that it's a big win for environmentalists and municipalities and a loss for the state and industry.
4 years ago, the Supreme Court struck down a major part of the state's new gas law, declaring local towns should be able to decide where gas drilling takes place. But other issues within the law remained unresolved. Now the court has ruled that taking land for natural gas storage through eminent domain is unconstitutional. It also decided that private water well owners need to be notified in case of a spill. And the so-called Dr. Gag rule, which forced medical professionals to sign non-disclosure forms to get information needed to treat patients exposed to drilling or fracking chemicals, is also unconstitutional. Jordan Yeager is the attorney who argued for towns and environmentalists.
It's great for the residents of Pennsylvania to have the courts recognize that their rights matter more than gas industry's power in Harrisburg.
The ruling also eliminates the role of the Public Utility Commission in reviewing local zoning rules. State agencies say they're still reviewing the decision. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Late this afternoon, the Marcellus Shale Coalition expressed disappointment with the decision. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf has addressed the General Assembly about what can be done to combat the opioid addiction crisis in Pennsylvania. Specifically, Wolf used the rare opportunity to renew his call for legislation strengthening the state's prescription drug monitoring program and limiting prescription of opioids. Senate Majority Leader Jake Corman notes that one bill generally won't solve a big problem, so the Senate has sent three proposals on opioid education and regulation onto the House.
We in the legislature have a tendency to be aimless. You read something in the paper, you see something on TV, and you go out and you introduce a bill the next day and say you solved the problem, and really you don't.
Bradford County Republican Senator Gene Yaw was among several senators saying they are committed to getting some of the proposals passed. Political rhetoric around voter fraud has ramped up as the presidential election draws near. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that Harrisburg is weighing a bill expanding who can act as a candidate's eyes and ears at Pennsylvania polling places next month.
On Election Day, poll watchers monitor voting places looking for misconduct. That even extends to what the poll workers are eating for lunch.
Heck, my opponent used to take in hoagies to the poll workers with his name on the hoagie.
Bill sponsor Mark Saccone is a Republican state representative from south of Pittsburgh.
And you're not allowed to do that.
Poll watchers may also challenge any voter on the spot and require proof of eligibility, something that can cross over into intimidation. Under state law, poll watchers must be registered in the county where they volunteer. Saccone's bill would lift that provision, allowing candidates to invite watchers to be their lookouts in any part of the state. David Thornburg, president of the nonpartisan Good Government Group, Committee of 70, says fast-tracking a change to voting law this close to an election makes him leery.
I can't evaluate this proposal without bringing in the context of what Donald Trump said several weeks back about how the only way that Hillary wins in Pennsylvania is if massive fraud occurs.
The Republican presidential candidate called on supporters to look for fraud on Election Day and is signing up observers on his campaign website. Montgomery County has the third most registered voters in the state. Chair of its Board of Elections, Val Arkush, says officials receive very few complaints from or about poll watchers.
We have really had no problems with this process. Complaints have been extremely rare.
Introduced in January, the bill has been recently revised and propelled into committee. If passed, it would go into effect immediately. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
There's a housing trend picking up momentum across Philadelphia, converting old churches into apartments and condos. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports on the forces driving the movement and who wins and who loses when a former church morphs into apartments.
Melissa McCormick started her search for a Philadelphia apartment after landing a job at an IT consulting company, and she came across a church. Its clock tower, old brick exterior, and stained glass windows don't exactly scream upscale lofts.
Taxi drivers, Uber drivers are always like, "Are you sure this is where you want me to let you out?"
The former church in the Graduate Hospital neighborhood is known as Sanctuary Lofts, And to McCormick, it was more appealing than a shiny new condo building.
It feels a little less like gentrification just because, at least in the case of this building, it was just standing here abandoned before.
It's happening more and more. As demographic changes shrink church congregations and more parishes merge, a new glut of empty church buildings is emerging across the city. In the Philly area, the number of Catholic parishes has dropped 18% in the last 5 years, reflecting a national trend. To developers, that's an opportunity.
I am so happy that these buildings that were placed in the heart of residential neighborhoods in dense urban areas are finding a second life.
Developer Leo Volosian has St. Laurentius and Fishtown under contract. He has hopes of doing 23 apartments there. Over the past 5 years, nearly a dozen former churches in Philly have been transformed into housing. But as Volosian found, there are many pains along the way. At a packed public zoning meeting recently, Kate Davis-Horan was among those who came to express concerns.
Have you given any thought to perhaps making less dense units and providing some type of service, a business, perhaps something that will add to our community, to the fabric of our community?
She lives right next to the empty St. Laurentius.
I don't want to see the building get torn down, but I do think we can do better than 23 teeny tiny units in this historical building.
She'd rather the space have public use, but she's also concerned about parking and neighborhood crowding issues. Area resident Jesse Gardner is also skeptical.
The outside of the building is a shell, and it's a beautiful thing visually, but it's very minimal in terms of asset compared to what it could be if it's kept as a sacred space.
It's the kind of neighborhood backlash that happens almost every time a church development is proposed in the city. Some wish it would revert back to a church. Others want a reuse that doesn't mean adding dozens more people to their street. But to developers like Volosian, housing is the safest bet. The church's high ceiling will even allow him to add a second floor.
Just to get enough utilization out of the building so that we can, you know, have enough of a profit to take on the risk of preserving the building.
Bob Yeager is president of Philly-based Partners for Sacred Places. He says it's great that more churches are finding a second life as apartments, but the concerned residents have a point.
I think it's a societal question. How do we encourage healthy transitions from congregational use to other uses?
Whether healthy or not, about a third of all church conversions in the city have been residential. One issue Yeager hears a lot with putting apartments in former churches is that the space ends up serving a very different role to the community than it did as a church. That doesn't please everyone.
Yes, people have homes, but it doesn't house programs for the arts anymore. It doesn't serve kids anymore. It doesn't serve the homeless anymore. It doesn't feed anybody anymore.
But Volosian and other developers say making a church into, for instance, a nonprofit community space wouldn't pay the bills. And Yeager says without university or other institutional support, that's often true.
In most neighborhoods, the single biggest demand is for residential. And so developers are naturally looking to these buildings to think about how they could be sensitively reused in a way that would preserve that character.
Back in Fishtown, standing in front of St. Laurentius, Volosian says it would have been a lot easier starting from the ground up. Because the building has a historical designation, every small change to the exterior has to be approved by the Historical Commission. It's not something every developer would be willing to go through. But he says, how could anyone rip down the oldest Polish church in the city?
It has tall, majestic spires that oftentimes have a falcon roosting on them. They have a beautiful green patina. The church is just awe-inspiring. You walk in and you look up and the baby blue ceiling is really just kind of brings it all to life.
But if Volosian's dreams come true, the only people who will see that baby blue ceiling will be the second floor tenants. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
In addition to classroom obligations and extracurricular activities, Princeton students are gaining an understanding in the importance of bringing diversity, equity, and notions of inclusion into their day-to-day interactions with other students and folks on campus. Let's go to school with LaTanya Buck, Princeton's new Dean of Diversity. Dean Buck, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How did this position come about?
Well, actually, the position was created from a special task force on diversity, equity, and inclusion at the institution about 2 years ago. I learned of the position at the end of 2015. It was very looked like a very interesting opportunity to work very closely with the Carl A. Field Center for Cultural Understanding and Equality, the Women's Center, the LGBT Center, as well as to focus on strategic diversity and inclusion initiatives.
Was it attractive in part because of Princeton's recent legacy, the controversy over the Woodrow Wilson name and its use on buildings?
No, I would not say that. Actually, around the time that the position was posted, much of what was happening on campus was a lot of the student protests and demonstrations. And so at my previous institution, I had definitely been involved with a lot of that same sort of activity. My position at Washington University was also an inaugural position, and so I had the opportunity to work very collaboratively with many constituents within the community there. And so it included faculty, staff, students, as well as community members to develop a new center for diversity and inclusion. I think that it certainly helped me in my transition here with learning how to start a very new role at Princeton. And so what I would say worked is that I had the opportunity to develop very cohesive infrastructure and model for the department there at the institution. And it wasn't done in a silo, for sure. I worked very closely with a lot of colleagues in that way. And so I think that that experience there has certainly prepared me for this experience here.
How does the theory then apply to the student body?
I see my role as assisting and contributing to a lot of other individuals at the institution to help create a more welcoming and inclusive, I like to say challenging, environment for students, as well as a supportive space for them. And so that's part of how I see this role trickling down within the student body and the campus culture and the climate and the feel of the space.
Dean Buck, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Oh, thank you.
LaTanya Buck is Princeton's new Dean of Diversity and Inclusion. Still ahead, chairs have changed a lot over the centuries, but have they gotten more comfortable?
The Klismos is just as good a chair as an Aeron chair. It's a different sort of chair, but you can't say Aeron's a better chair.
A chair historian takes the hot seat when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. You may want to take a seat for this next segment and then consider just what you're sitting on. In his new book, Now I Sit Me Down, author Witold Rybczynski explains that sitting in a chair is not a universally accepted habit. Many developed cultures evolve by sitting on mats, on cushions, or squatting on the floor. Rybczynski is a professor emeritus of architecture at the University of Pennsylvania. He's written a history of the chair. Rybczynski spoke with WHYY's Peter Crimmins.
In the book, you start with very, very ancient chairs, folding stools that were used thousands and thousands of years ago, and you sort of move up into the Greek klismos chair, which was made, I'm not sure when it was made. What era are we talking about, the klismos chair?
I think it was around 1000 BC, but it's a very old chair.
You describe it as a perfect chair.
It's considered, not just by me, but it's generally considered one of the most beautiful chairs ever conceived. And ever since sort of the 18th century, famous architects have tried to design their version of the klismos.
So when I'm reading a book like this, which really describes the evolution of sitting and chair design, to reach early in the story the perfect chair, we've already reached the apex of chair evolution. The klismos is the perfect chair. So let's order one for everyone in the world and move on and cure cancer or something. But we haven't had that. I mean, the klismos chair disappeared.
Yeah, the Romans ignored it. There are no Roman versions. The Romans took a lot of stuff from the Greeks, including their temples, but they ignored the klismos. They had no interest in the klismos. But, you know, the evolution is a kind, maybe not the right word, because the chair doesn't really evolve. The klismos is just as good a chair as an Aeron chair. I mean, it's a different sort of chair, but you can't say Aeron's a better chair. And that I think that's the reason that chairs have such long lives. When I was teaching at Penn, I had a Windsor chair in my office. That's the same chair that Ben Franklin sat on. It's a perfectly good chair. So in one way, the puzzle is that we have these perfect chairs and then we forget about them. Fashion changes, our taste changes. Sometimes materials change. So, you know, we're trying to make chairs out of plastic so that the chair changes because we're making it out of a different material. So it's not so much an evolution as this kind of weird back and forth.
Everyone who sets out to design a chair is facing a problem. As you write, that humans aren't really designed to sit. They're designed to do a lot of things, but to sit comfortably for long periods of time is not one of them.
That's right. Basically, if the body is captured in one position for any period of time, you start losing blood flow, and your cells are starting to die. So you need to move around. You need to cross your legs and lean on the left, lean on the right. And ultimately, the best really comfortable chair is one that allows all that movement. And ultimately, you just have to stand up and walk around. I mean, there's no chair that you can sit in for, as we know from plane rides. If you sit long enough in a chair, you just get sore and you feel uncomfortable. You have to get up.
Well, I want to put you on the spot just for a second because we're sitting in chairs right now. We're sitting in a recording studio on basically office furniture.
Right.
These are desk chairs. They swivel, they rock, they have armrests, and they have wheels, caster wheels on the bottom. And you've been sitting here for quite a while because you've been doing interviews today. So you've been sitting in that chair for a while. Are these good chairs?
These chairs are upholstered and they're hot. And that's not comfortable when you're sitting for half an hour, an hour. It's interesting because the chair, the tilting, swiveling chair on casters started off in the living room. It was not a office furniture. It was a living room chair. And it was basically, and it was American invention, it was a version of a rocking chair. Rocking chairs were popular and people were trying to figure out something that would attract people who liked rocking chairs, but wasn't a rocking chair, something new. Americans are always looking for new things. And these mechanical chairs were an attempt to simulate rocking, which a lot of people do in office chairs. They kind of rock back and forth. And it was only later that they migrated to the office. And the funny thing is now they're in the office, and they really are better chairs than most chairs. I'm waiting for them to migrate back, but they don't seem to. They're kind of stuck in the office.
I'm speaking with Witold Rybczynski. His new book is Now I Sit Me Down. It's a natural history of chairs and sitting. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, I wish I was in heaven sitting down.
Often, a medical diagnosis can bring an answer, a solution, even relief. This evening on Story Corner, we hear from a young woman who had a different reaction. For years, Serenity Berezini found workarounds to her extreme unease in public. Then she struggled with the decision whether to seek an official diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome.
Let me set the scene for you. It's hot outside, and we're sitting near some old children's playground toys, eating ice cream. The summer smells like riding old bicycles and blueberries. We talk for the longest time about Goosebumps books and what being alive feels like. I remember him mentioning something about wondering if the living dead still counts as being alive. Dakota has autism. He is high-functioning and a heck of a good time to talk to and hang out with. Out of all the friends I've had, I probably feel the most comfortable and can relate to autistic ones the most. People just don't seem to understand the way I think, so when they can follow my train of thought, it feels like I have superpowers. I'm with my regular group of friends at lunch when the new kid at school comes to join us. I have no clue who he is, what he's like, his social patterns, or how I can interact with him. It's absolutely terrifying. I remember the past experiences I've had with meeting new people, and when characters on Degrassi Junior High met new people. I reenact the responses that I know can work. I don't even realize what I'm doing as I'm doing it. I do this all the time, and not just when I'm meeting new people. I do this in almost all social situations that have me like a deer in headlights. Not until recently did I learn this wasn't normal, but it is common in girls on the same part of the spectrum we suspect I'm on. Before I landed on a possible Asperger's diagnosis, counselors and doctors suggested other things. OCD, severe ADHD, anxiety, and that's just naming a few. The biggest thing is just really that we don't know for sure. It's like putting a puzzle together in the dark. It's difficult to put the pieces together, but not difficult to find them. And once you do put all the pieces together, you still aren't sure what the puzzle looks like. That's what it felt like trying to solve this mystery. I chose not to interview anyone for this commentary because people don't often like talking to me about it. They seem uncomfortable, like they are unsure of what to say. If they do engage, they ask questions that even I don't know the answers to, which in turn makes me uncomfortable. My true friends choose not to talk about it merely because it doesn't matter to them. What society has made out of the idea of being autistic is the stereotypical, low-functioning autistic person. In society, having the label of being autistic could mean being treated as if I'm less than the rest of the people out there. It could also mean that I could be put on a pedestal. Sadly, it seems like it's easier to just not say anything at all. I'm haunted by the possibilities of the unknown portion of this. I really want a diagnosis, but I'm not sure if I'm quite ready to make a life-changing decision at the minuscule age of 14. If by some weird event I do get diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, I have no idea where I'll go from there. All I know is that whether or not I get tested, or even diagnosed for that matter, I'll always be the number-loving, football-playing punk rocker that I always have been.
Serenity Barazzini wrote this essay for Mighty Writers. Production help was provided by Ann Hoffman. The writings of others in our region are available at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. You can find our podcast on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.